perhaps he was one of those undecided ones who held their reservations close to their chest. The voice of the announcer returned. It was time to board. I found myself standing at the front of the line, Diana beside me. She had, on more than one occasion, taken me to the town where she was born in Northern California. I know the plants and the color of the light and the distances where she grew up. Now I was, finally, taking her to my land. She had packed the Hasselblad and the Leica, her two favorite cameras, and 100 rolls of film. Diana works with great fidelity. Once she gets hold of a thread, she will follow it until the end. Knowing this excited and worried me. I'm reluctant to give Libya any more than it has already taken. Mother was pacing by the windows that looked onto the runway, speaking on her mobile phone. People, mostly men, began to fill the terminal. Diana and I were now standing at the head of a long line. It bent behind us like a river. I pretended I had forgotten something and pulled her to one side. Returning after all these years was a bad idea, I suddenly thought. My family had left in 1979, 33 years earlier. This was the chasm that divided the man from the 8-year-old boy I was then. The plane was going to cross that gulf. Surely such journeys were reckless. This one could rob me of a skill that I have worked hard to cultivate, how to live away from places and people I love. Joseph Brodsky was right. So were Nabokov and Conrad. They were artists who never returned. Each had tried, in his own way, to cure himself of his country. What you have left behind has dissolved. Return and you will face the absence or the defacement of what you treasured. But Dmitri Shostakovich and Boris Pasternak and Naguib Mahfouz were also right. Never leave the homeland. Leave and your connections to the source will be severed. You will be like a dead trunk, hard and hollow. What do you do when you cannot leave and cannot return? Back in October 2011, I had considered never returning to Libya. I was in New York, walking up Broadway, the air cold and swift, when the proposition presented itself. It seemed immaculate, a thought my mind had manufactured independently. As in youthful moments of drunkenness, I felt bold and invincible. I had gone to New York the previous month, at the invitation of Barnard College, to lecture on novels about exile and estrangement, but I had an older connection to the city. My parents had moved to Manhattan in the spring of 1970, when my father was appointed first secretary to the Libyan mission to the United Nations. I was born that autumn. 3 years later, in 1973, we returned to Tripoli. In the years since, I had visited New York maybe 4 or 5 times, and always briefly. So although I had just returned to the city of my birth, it was a place I hardly knew. In the 36 years since we left Libya, my family and I had built associations with several surrogate cities. Nairobi, where we went on our escape from Libya in 1979, and have continued to visit ever since. Cairo, where we settled into indefinite exile the following year. Rome, a vacation spot for us. London, where I went at the age of 15 for my studies, and where for 29 years I have been doggedly trying to make a life for myself. Paris, where, fatigued and annoyed by London, I moved in my early 30s, vowing never to return to England, only to find myself back 2 years later. In all these cities, I had pictured myself one day calm and living in that faraway island, Manhattan, where I was born. I would imagine a new acquaintance asking me, perhaps at a dinner party or in a cafe or in changing rooms after a long swim, that old tiresome question, "Where are you from?" And I, unfazed and free of the usual agitation, would casually reply, "New York."